Fernando Nikolić has lived Bitcoin's narrative journey from Argentina to Blockstream and now building Perception. He joins us to explore how Sharper's storytelling can shape Bitcoin's next chapter and drive real adoption for builders on the protocol. As a reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only. If you enjoy our content, please remember to like, share, or leave us a comment, as this all helps us greatly.
This isn't for everyone. It's for the ones who know the old system is broken and are ready to build something that lasts. Welcome to the Build with Bitcoin podcast.
I'm co-host Israel Munoz, joined with co-host Lynn Bairstow. Today we have the pleasure of welcoming on to the podcast Fernando Nikolić from Perception. So Fernando, we're excited to get into today's conversation. We have plenty to cover with you regarding narrative intelligence and the platform that you're building. We have a lot to get into there, and we'll explain in a little more detail exactly what that means, who your clients are, and how you've gotten to where you are. But as a starting point, we'd like to get to know you a little more, as much as you're comfortable sharing with us your background. You grew up in Argentina, which is a country that's experienced its fair share of capital controls and currency devaluations. So I'm personally also curious, and I'm certain there is a connection there with your Bitcoin story, but you know, if you can take us back as far as you'd like, what your upbringing was and what led you to Bitcoin.
Yeah, you know, I think everybody at some point, several points in life, they kind of like take a retrospective into their lives and career. And you know, for me, every time I do it, it's always like a straight line. There's a lot of stuff that in the moment might not be making a lot of sense, but then looking back, you can definitely see that, okay, there's a lot of reason to the different things that has happened to me personally that led me to where I'm at today. And yeah, it all started back in Argentina. You know, I'm originally from Argentina, but when I was a kid, in the late 80s, in 89, my mom emigrated from Argentina and went to Norway to start over. What happened in the late 80s in Argentina at that time was kind of like a mix of, you know, 1983, we had come out of a military dictatorship that lasted about almost a decade, from 76 to 83. And from 83 to the end of the 80s, when my mom had enough, was a insane period in history where Argentina literally changed the capital from Buenos Aires to a random town called Viedma. They changed the currency's name, printed new bills with different colors, added a couple of zeros, removed some zeros. It was like an insane, like 5-6 years after the military dictatorship had ended, where essentially my dad, who had several restaurants, several cars, had a lot of assets, were forced to sell everything just to have some liquidity to pay staff, pay the bills. And then that didn't help because the inflation kept on happening. So we ended up losing everything. And my mom went to Norway to restart. And I grew up between Norway and Argentina ever since I was, you know, around 5 years. And every time I went back to visit the rest of my family, my dad stayed in Argentina, the rest of the family stayed in Argentina. And every time I went back, as I grew older, I started like understanding that inflation is a topic that a lot of people in Argentina was constantly discussing. My family, strangers, friends of family. And I was like, what is this inflation thing that just keeps being a topic of conversation, a very hot one at that? But in Norway, that was never talked about inflation. No, it was all good with the currency in Norway. So why wasn't this happening in Argentina? So, you know, when I entered my teens and stuff, I started like reading some books, and I was always very entrepreneurial. I started a record label when I was 16 years old, which I exited at 18, 19 years old, which led me to start a career as a product manager in the music business. And throughout that time, I was just reading and trying to understand why this inflation thing happened. And that led me to, you know, the classic Austrian economics, the Hayek's, the Mises, the Rothbards. And then fast forward to 2017, a friend of mine introduced me to Bitcoin, and I understood Bitcoin from the concept of like the monetary properties and making a comparison between my lived experience in Argentina with inflation and my family's experience. and the theory behind the Austrian economics. And I put two and two together and I was like, okay, Bitcoin makes sense to me because it has a predictable inflationary, you can predict up to 2140 how much will actually be issued and put into circulation. I was like, okay, that is special. And the fact that nobody can control it, no matter how much supply, no matter how much demand there is for Bitcoin, was like the two major things that really led me to believe in Bitcoin. And I was consulting at that time, and I started to get paid in Bitcoin in 2017, early 2017, which then was like my introduction to the whole industry, to the whole community, and for me, just like learning about Bitcoin, all the way to 2021 when I ended the consulting business to focus full time on Blockstream in 2021, which I then led the marketing and communications team until 2025, where I started Star Perception. So that's fast forward. That's the TLDR on my background. I don't want this to be too much of a monologue, but yeah, that's kind of like, that's the timeline.
It's interesting, Fernando, that you were in the marketing part of Blockstream. And when you looked at Blockstream, which is one of Bitcoin's most significant infrastructure companies, how did you shape the narrative? Because you worked on different products within Blockstream, like you worked on Liquid, I think was one of the primary areas of focus, but then also other narratives. Was there a company wide strategy about how you talked about Bitcoin, or how did you think about that as you evolved into the director of marketing for the company?
Well, back in 2021, when I started, things were very rough. It was just like, very engineering heavy company. So, the biggest voices were the ones that were like deep into the cryptography space. And, a lot of white papers were published in the 2010s, sidechains and a lot of cryptography white papers were published back then that gave, people like Andrew Polstra, Nick Jonas, and other ex-block streamers like, GMAX and Peter Willey, a lot of fame, I would say. But it was still the communication through the white papers and the conversations that was happening in the forums and stuff like that was just mostly very technically focused. And so the language was just like not very, how can you say, it's not very adaptable for the rest of the mainstream normies, right? So it had like by default a fate where it would just live and die within those like internal circles of like highly technical people who knew, very deep things about the technical aspects of Bitcoin. That was on that side, right? That was like a cohort where Blockstream had built a lot of goodwill and built a brand very, very heavy around that, which is fine. There's a lot of other like diehard that technical Bitcoiners who kind of like grasp the technical aspects of it, who were also, pretty like big fan of Blockstream. But outside of the core Bitcoiner, hardcore Bitcoin maxi, technically inclined people, I don't think the Blockstream brand was that prevalent back then. And there was also a lot of misunderstandings in terms of Liquid and like the Liquid network, the protocol, the sidechains, that what is a real L2 or not. And there's a lot of like, in my opinion, just like very useless debate around that. That was like very frustrating to see because I think anyone who wants Bitcoin to win needs to be in support of many different applications and protocols that might be tethered to the base layer. You don't need to necessarily love it or unconditionally support it, but I think you should be open and accepted of like a lot of people doing different things. And I think there was like a part of that like Bitcoin maxi hardcore cohort that was just like not accepting anything unless it was on the base layer. And I think that was like a real branding challenge for Blockstream, but also for Bitcoin as a whole, to be honest, because you don't really grow the ecosystem the way it should be or at the speed it should be by being so like anti just for the cause of being anti. But then at the same time, on the flip side, 2021 and the period where I was at Blockstream that lasted until 2025 was really the period, looking back now, where the institutions started to be interested and started allocating to Bitcoin because of Saylor in 2020, right? And maybe Elon Musk and you know, Tesla around that same time as well, right? So I definitely felt a little change where Blockstream had a lot of opportunities to position itself for the institutional audience. So we shifted a lot of, you know, the messaging and the positioning to be more welcoming for that audience as well.
Lynn and I are partners at Base Layer Advisors, where through our experience and network with venture capital partners, we connect interested investors with unique opportunities in the space and advise startups on their growth and fundraising. Visit our website's advisory section to learn more.
Fernando, not only were the institutions getting more involved or more intrigued by Bitcoin at that time, but also individuals, because I think 2020, 2021, after the kind of the money printing of the COVID stimulus, I think a lot of people started looking at what was happening, and that also was a big realm. Did Blockstream have aspirations to kind of navigate or attract individual retail investors at that time, or a retail interest in it? And was it also a good time to attract engineering talent to come into Blockstream?
Well, I think Blockstream has always tried to target different audiences at the same time. And I think the retail audience, I think the main thing was what was called the green wallet back in the day. And then 2021, I think, was just like the very first iteration of the Jade wallet, the most basic version of it. I think it was released in 2020, right before I started. That was kind of like the two products that we have for retail. But it was very new. It was very rough. I think the user experience for a lot of like retail focused products like wallets and hardware wallets was very rough back then, not so user friendly. It's been insane to see how much better, you know, the like many Bitcoin companies who are offering retail products have improved not only the design, but also the usability, the entire user experience is just so much better. But so even though Blockstream had two retail products back then, I think looking back, it was just like way too rough to really get people excited that they weren't part of like the immediate core, you know, Bitcoin audience, because you needed to have some technical chops in order to understand how to work around those products. So yeah, it was a it was a focus in terms of having products, but I don't think it was a focus in terms of like making those products really accessible. But I don't think that's a Blockstream thing. That was like just an entire industry thing back in the early 2020s.
This is a good kind of soft transition into what led you to Perception, because you just hit on some interesting points here that that I think ring true for anyone who's been in the space. I think can relate to this, and anyone new to the space as well, that Bitcoin does kind of have a bit of a marketing challenge to your earlier points. I mean, if you look at it from the monetary angle, there's really never been a monetary system quite like this. If you look at it from the technology angle, there's other things that can appear to be shinier. So it can be a bit of a challenge to navigate, you know, information, and perhaps that led you to founding an intelligence platform, and we'll get into exactly what Perception does and if that is the gap that you were trying to address. But before that, Fernando, I want to touch on something that I've seen you've talked about before, which is Bitcoin is not for everyone, which is a controversial way to put it. Someone famous in the space recently published a book that is literally called Bitcoin is for everyone. So I'm sure there's plenty behind your reasoning there and what you're trying to get at. But can you expand on this idea?
Yeah, and it's you know, it's funny to do that, because it's it has so many different meanings. It's not like literal, like, and I also, I partially do it also to troll a little bit online, because I love to see the reaction. I love to get people a little bit triggered, but it is something that I truly, from my point of view, I have understood it, in the way that Bitcoin as it is right now, we're still very early, right? I think a lot of Bitcoiners love to say that, but like, if you really take a look at, in terms of, you know, analogies that Bitcoiners love to use, which is like comparing Bitcoin to the printing press, for example, right? If you take a look at the printing press, when Gutenberg invented it, it changed the world, but not in his lifetime. You know, the printing press led to a series of events that culminated in many different wars, a lot of regime changes, a lot of cultural changes, you know, people literally fleeing, escaping their country and starting new empires elsewhere. So the ramifications of the actual printing press from inception was like a 300-year revolution, right? And Bitcoin is the same thing. And if we are, and I agree with the analogy of the of Bitcoin being at the level of the printing press in terms of like the revolutionary potential, then we haven't seen any of that change in the last 17 years. So in this lifetime that we are in, before all of us die, we're not going to see, in my opinion, we're not going to see Bitcoin become this like globally accepted, both sovereign store of value and medium of exchange where you can go and you can buy bananas and your grandma will be using Bitcoin to pay her pension. Maybe in a further future, but not within our lifetime, because I don't believe the products are here yet. We don't have the conviction as an industry to really go out there and get our shit. I think a lot of people who are builders, you can compare this to like people who are building AI. I would even venture to say people who are building in shitcoin protocols, they have way more, they're more out there. And Bitcoiners, we as a community, we do two things. One is good, the other one is wrong. The good thing is we are patient and we take our time and we're very careful about changing stuff. That I think is a great property. But the second thing that we do, which is kind of like, it's kind of like an oxymoron, which I think is really bad, is thinking that Bitcoin has already won because you think it's great. Just because we think it's great doesn't mean 98.7% of the rest of the world who are not yet using Bitcoin are going to believe it's amazing. And one thing that we have done a very bad job in terms of communicating the values of Bitcoin is thinking that the arguments that won you over personally, as an individual, is going to be the exact same arguments that's going to win everybody else over. So a lot of Bitcoiners who have taken upon themselves to be the, like, I'm going to orange pill the world and I'm going to like tell everybody that they need to get on this train, they essentially are just repeating the stuff that convinced them, right? And if I like the monetary properties, and because of my Argentinian background and living in Norway and reading Austrian economics, understand Bitcoin in a way that makes sense to me, that's beautiful. But I'm not going to go to 100 people and beat them over the head of like, you need to understand Argentina's inflationary history. You need to read the, you know, Mises. You need to do this and that. So we don't have this like ability to be like, hey, sit down with me and let me hear you. You know, and like, what are you trying to do? What is your challenge? What are like the pains that you're trying to solve here? And let me be sophisticated enough to think in my head as you tell me these things, how Bitcoin can fit in. But we don't do that. We're just like bang, 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 bang on top of people's heads and expect everybody to love it. And it's just like, no, it's not going to happen. So if we do that on the conceptual side, and then on the side as an industry, we have like very shitty products, it's going to be a slow burn. And I don't think we are not building in isolation here. We have a lot of people competing for the mental space as well. So that's why, you know, I look at Argentina, for example, and even in Argentina, people should love Bitcoin, right? Because of all the inflation that has happened. And guess what? The Ethereum community is bigger in Argentina than the Bitcoin community, right? It's because the Ethereum community has gone and actually listened to the Argentinians, and they're like, okay, so you wanna not emigrate from Argentina. You wanna stay in Argentina with your family, but you want to open up a laptop and maybe make some money in Argentina outside of the peso system. Okay, Ethereum and Solana, you got a lot of other stuff that you can do. And it's like, you can take that, you can exchange it to USDT and you can like live off that. You know, those people understand that. They don't care about the protocol. They just care about the stuff that they care about to be fixed. And if we are just like, no, bro, you got to read the white paper, bro. You got to read the Rothbard, bro. We're going to have like one out of 1,000 to really be on our team. So that's why Bitcoin is not for everyone. because of the extremely bad job that we've done as a community and as an industry. But also, let me finish the rant. I also don't think that a majority of the world are capable to really understand what Bitcoin is about. You have to really understand that financial literacy is at an all-time low, okay, around the globe. But especially in the global south, especially in Argentina, you have a lot of people who don't know what money is. They don't know how to define it. And every time they have a problem, they don't look for solutions to become entrepreneurial or to build a business. The solutions they look for is politicians, governments, political parties. And that's just the way of the world. So I just don't think that Bitcoin is ever going to be like this huge, like changing the world is going to be a hyper Bitcoinized world. Everybody's going to be on a Bitcoin standard. I think it's always going to be a niche. But since we are so early, this niche has a lot of room to grow. It's going to be way bigger than what it is right now, but it's not going to like literally take over the world like a lot of Bitcoiners think it's going to do. So I'm going to stop it there because there's way more angles, but I think that's kind of like my main thesis.
As you're talking, I just am feeling so guilty because I'm definitely, you know, I go at it from the technology standpoint, and I'm thinking to myself as you're talking, how few people really care what the underlying technology of a protocol is. So my Orangeville story is probably the worst of all of them. But, you know, let's shift it and talk about perception, because what you're actually doing, the company that you've created, is measuring how people see Bitcoin, see digital assets, and you're measuring kind of the shifts that take place as a society of how we're starting to accept it. And I know, you know, from the early days when I first got in like 2012, 2013, if I talked about it, it was really considered like an illegal form of transferring value. And I kind of learned not to talk about it as I was raising a venture fund because it sent the wrong message. And although I followed it over the years, and I think that narrative has, for the most part, gone away. But Fernanda, talk to us a little bit about what is perception. How would you describe what it does, and what the value proposition of perception is?
Yeah, so perception is a narrative intelligence platform, as I like to call it. That doesn't really mean anything to people. So the elevator pitch is the following: basically, take everything that is being discussed about Bitcoin in the realm of the digital asset industry. So Bitcoin and adjacent stuff. Like mining, data centers, computing, tokenizing of finance, capital markets, treasuries, and everything else in between. And I distill it. I synthesize everything that is happening on every single day in real time. Not only giving you the data in terms of like who and what is being talked about, but also some research and analysis that comes like made for you. So you can think of stuff like, if the BBC, for example, who has been covering Bitcoin negatively for, you know, the entire existence, all of a sudden flips and starts covering Bitcoin favorably, perception catches that and tells you, hey, now you should maybe look at the BBC because there's a pivot in the narratives. Another example is, if a white paper is being created about stablecoins, from the central bank in Italy. Now we catch that and we tell that to you, like, okay, here's a regulatory intel that weighs more than just a random guy on Twitter, and this is the thesis from the Central Bank of Italy. And these are like individual data points. Another example is if a leadership at a public mining company is all of a sudden very evasive in terms of the earnings calls and the questions that they get during that earnings call, we flag that. And then you can extrapolate all of those individual data points, and you can start clustering them into actual trend clusters. So, for example, if the leadership of Hut 8 or Mara all of a sudden changes their stance on something they said 3 quarters ago, perception flags that. If somebody on Twitter, if Adam Back all of a sudden is bullish on BIP 110, perception will tell you that. So it's all of those things that is about like narrative gaps, trend clustering, sentiment analysis, things that are incredibly hard to identify in real time the old school way, meaning having like 75 tabs, so maybe three or four research analysts constantly looking at everything online. Perception distills all of that for you and just gives it to you in three different ways. You have a platform that you can log into where like there's some curation and you can create some workers to fetch data for you and feed it to you over Slack or Telegram or email. Or you can just plug it directly to our API to build your own dashboard, or through the MCP if you want to plug it into Claude or ChatGPT or Google Gemini. And essentially, then you can just like have a conversation and have access to hundreds of thousands of data rows that has everything to do with your industry. And the people that are currently my customers, I would say 80-90% of the total are people who are like in the business of distilling information and adding context to that. So everybody from like content creators to VP of marketing to growth people to investor relations, comms, PR agencies, these people are using Perception now in many different ways. And it's been a crazy whirlwind the last 7 months or so since I left Blockstream to pursue this. But I've been onboarding incredibly important companies like BitGo, BitcoinWell, Relay. And for those who don't know, BitGo is one of the leading infrastructure companies publicly listed in the New York Stock Exchange in the U.S. BitcoinWell is also one of the most important Canadian publicly listed companies. They have treasury, they have ATMs, and they also work as an exchange. And then Relay is the biggest European Bitcoin-only exchange as well. And then I have a bunch of others that I can't name right now. But yeah, it's been incredibly humbling to pursue this full time and onboard so many important companies and people that are using it like crazy. I love going into my dashboard and see how much MCP usage is, and it's always like a new all-time high. And just people like really using MCP. And this is also a reflection of where we are right now. I think a lot of companies are downsizing and they're trying to do a lot with AI. And I think it's, since code is commoditized, people can build their own internal tools and dashboards as much as they want. But then, you know, plugging in the right data to these things, that's kind of like where if you want to build a business, I believe that's kind of like where you need to try to build a competitive moat, have like data that doesn't exist anywhere and inject that into companies' internal workflows as they are changing so drastically right now. So, yeah, that's Perception. That's the TLDR on Perception.
I mean, it's fascinating, Fernando. You're essentially, is it fair to say, like you're adding an intelligence layer onto a bunch of different news sources. So, and that's what makes this, you know, different, let's say, when people think of adjacent tools, such as just going to, you know, fetch the latest in Bloomberg or, you know, NewHedge, Google Alerts. We have a few tools that allow us to try to gather information, but I'm assuming the user can also define certain parameters on what, you know, it's most interested in, and then make these subtle connections that aren't always as obvious.
Yeah, and it's not only news. It's like we track SEC filings. We have like regulatory stuff. We have very hard to find. We are reselling APIs. You know, we are going out of our way to really fetch a lot of data that is hard to get as well. You would have to just like be extremely hacky if you want to do it yourself. And we are also able to, you know, intelligently create transcripts from like conferences, panels, keynote speeches. So it's okay. Just more than news. It's 1,000 different sources, LinkedIn, social media, X, and even GitHub repos. If there's any discussions in a GitHub repo, we gather all of that. That's one thing that's incredibly hard to do, but then distilling that information and kind of like structuring it, that's also the other hard part, where you can preferably do it by yourself, but you would have to hire a full-time person to do that, because updating, cleaning, enriching, and gathering is such a laborious task that I think it's better off if you pay for a Perception subscription and have reliable data getting fed to you. It's way easier. And that's what a lot of these companies are understanding. Like, okay, we can probably do it ourselves, but it's, if you really want to do it right, it takes a lot of hours and maintenance. And, you know, one One very large company that I can't name was very like AI-pilled by the time I started, you know, doing demos, and we were talking about like how perception could fit in. And they were like, yeah, no, we already do all of this, right? And then I was like, okay, but why don't you do exactly what you have already built and just A-B test it and plug in perception to create content, right? Because they had like an institutional audience. They wanted to create like reports, and they wanted to like really go deep into the details and be very differentiated. They plugged in perception to the exact same tooling that they had built, and it was like night and day. And they're now a very happy enterprise customer. So it's all about the data. I think a lot of people are starting to understand that, you know, like you can commoditize code, you can build tools and dashboards, but the data, that's where the magic happens.
And I want to ask you a little bit more, you know, about some of the learnings that you found, but just to dive a little bit deeper, you mentioned content creators and comms and PR and analysts. Who would be a typical user? At what level of an organization, and what might they, how might they configure that to pull out the information that they want? Can you describe who you're talking to in the kind of the business development calls that you make?
Kind of like still trying to figure that out myself. And there's like, I do maybe like 5 or 10 demos a week, and they're all like very different. People have like a political, a guy who runs a guy who runs an organization focused on crypto donations to political parties. So many different people that are like all in the same business of like, there's a lot of information going on. I can't keep up. I need to get what I need that is relevant for me. And then from that, I need to create either compelling newsletters or build a dashboard for my sales team or my product team to monitor competitors. There's still like a bunch of different use cases that I'm still learning from my own users as well. But I think if I were to give you an answer of what I believe, but what I have believed has been drastically changed the last 7 months, so I don't know how valid it's going to be. But I think people who are controlling narratives, they want to see the narrative layer in terms of like, where are the narrative gaps? I want to be able to see using perception what is being talked about and if it's trending the right way. And then if it is trending, if it's not a false positive, let me see exactly what the discussion is about, because I can see, okay, mining is being discussed right now, but what exactly about mining is really the core discussion? And then if I'm a mining company, let's say I have my own like agents who I feed my company's brand DNA, my tone of voice, or maybe my CEO's, you know, LinkedIn style of content posting. Let me take that together with perception, and perception tells me then, this is the narrative gap that your company needs to fill. This is how you should talk about it. This is how you should pitch to, you know, to press about it. Or if you go to an interview to CNBC, this is how you should talk. These are your talking points for you to be differentiated in terms of like what everybody's talking about right now. Because the one thing that I think is a major, major brand problem in, you know, this AI age is that everybody's leveraging AI to write their content for them, and everybody starts like talking exactly the same, writing exactly the same, and everybody's like generating this collective slop. But if you don't know exactly like where your company can actually be differentiated from what everybody else is saying, your company and your brand is going to suffer from it, because you're going to just sound like everybody else. I think that edge is extremely important for people that are working in comms and PR and marketing. So I think that is at least, you know, 85% of my total customer base right now are those people. So I think, you know, that's kind of like the market validating that specific thesis.
Makes sense with the points you touch on as far as a bit of information saturation that we all kind of, you know, struggle with, and it's difficult to funnel the right information to curate content now, to your AI slop comments. I mean, I think you're of course a young company, but you're clearly addressing some very real pain points for your users. And it'll be very interesting to see how this evolves, you know, in a year from now or so. We'll have to check back in with you and see what the other, I guess what the other lessons learned have been. But and you mentioned, Fernando, is it so far the main use is on the MCP side? So people plugging their AIs directly into this?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep. It's two things that I'm observing is like we live in a time where like information is all over the place, right? Like you have so many sources, so many channels, everybody has a voice. Where's the signal? And, you know, how do you distill, how do you go through all of that? How do you comb through that, right? And that's going to be increasingly difficult. But I think it's a good thing because if you really take a look at history and the way that humans, in terms of like societies, communicated with each other and the information that they digested, they were really tribal. Back in the days, I think we have this like anomaly from the 1940s to the 2000s of like 70 year of like streamlined communication through mainstream channels. You know, I think our parents and other generations older than our parents can remember, hey, you know, we all went and saw the same movie in the cinemas. There was like a newsreel before the film. So we all saw the same news. And then the TV came and we had like the same three channels or two, three radio stations. We all kind of consumed the same content and everybody had something to talk about the next day at the office, the water cooler talk and stuff like that. And I think that was like an anomaly. That's not really how humans have really, really consumed information or even communicated with each other. We've all been tribal. You know, the fact that dialects exist and different accents and languages exist is because the tribes that were not really talking to each other, they just like evolved on their own, right? And talked among themselves. And I think the internet came and kind of like, we now think it's like an overflow of information, but if you really think about it, people going to Noster and quitting Twitter or going to Blue Sky because they're quitting Twitter or just hanging in different forums. And just like people are going back to that tribalism right now. And it's interesting because I think it is going to affect Bitcoin adoption a lot because we now have these tribes that will grow on their own because they have a very kind of like a, not a strict policy, but like they have a very deep common understanding about something very specific. Like if it if you stay on the Bitcoin topic, it's going to be like a gang that are like BIP 110 for life. And then another gang that's going to be like circular economy. I don't care about anything else. Then another tribe that is like, I don't care about circular economy. I'm all for the store of value, right? We already see these tribes kind of like, duking, getting at it online. And I think that's the future of adoption. These tribes are going to grow larger because they all have like influencers and channels and YouTube channels that speak to this. And they have incentives because like if they can talk clear about that, their audience will grow. So they go into this like incentive loop of like, I cannot stop talking about this specific thing because I got to keep growing my audience. So we're going to have like separated tribes that are like only consuming very specific content. So therefore their understanding of the world is going to be very specific and maybe sometimes contradictory to another tribe. And how do you, as a company in Bitcoin, that want to sell to all these different audiences, knowing that everybody's kind of like deeper and deeper into their own rabbit hole or their like echo chamber, how do you know how to position your company to those different tribes? Well, you got to take everything in one and then you got to analyze it through something like perception so that you can like make quick decisions and be like, okay, I can position my product or my brand or my CEO a very specific way in order to get these people on our team. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I mean, congrats on what you've built in under a year, Fernando, because you've clearly onboarded some big companies in the space. You got a mention from Javier Milei, I believe. Not every founder has a presidential mention, which, by the way, I mean, for those listening and maybe less familiar with the libertarian movement in Argentina, what does this all have to do with Bitcoin, if at all? What was Javier Milei's specific mention? Maybe we can briefly touch on that.
Well, it was a podcast I did with Peter McCormack. I believe it was the second podcast I did with him. Argentina was the main topic of discussion during that pod, and he was asking me about how everything was going on. And I broke down, not only how it went from like the boring like macroeconomical side, but also told Peter about like some cultural, like why Millet is such a cultural phenomenon. You know, like I really respect Millet because of his ability to distill something as boring and academic as the Austrian economics, right? Like back to the, like, you know, the beginning of this conversation, like Bitcoiners have been terrible at like bridging the gap between like this hardcore Austrian economics thesis and all this academia babble and distilling that into like a more like, you know, mainstream way that can appeal to normies. We've been terrible at that. Millet has been incredible at that. He went on television and kind of like became this cult figure before he won the elections by just really talking Mises to everybody and Hayek and all that stuff. But he did it in a way that was like very Argentinian. So it's like very, on brand for like the culture and what people already believe in. And his observations, he just translated stuff into the Argentinian model. And that kind of like, and then obviously his delivery and his looks, you know, all of that helped. But he's just like an extreme, like, insane content curator who can distill very complex ideas and make somebody from like the favelas of Buenos Aires understand it. And that's what I was explaining to Peter, you know, like that this is the real, like, this is the real power behind Millet. Like he can maybe change some laws or, you know, fix the economy, but I think the cultural change that that Millet has, that's the power behind Millet. And that was a clip that that got chopped by some random guy on Twitter, and Millet retweeted that, and yeah, it went viral. It was incredible to see.
Your previous points on getting the right messaging across and that it's not relatable. The same things that got you into it aren't necessarily relatable to the rest of the crowd, right? It reminds me, I don't know if you've seen that personality test, that those results of like people already in Bitcoin are a certain, I can't remember what the type is of personality type. And it's, I think, something along the lines of, you know, very curious and analytical, but I think that's like one of maybe a dozen personality types, right? Yeah. So, you know, I agree with what you were mentioning in the beginning that we've had a struggle of getting the right products into the masses, right? Making it easier to use and understand. I think we're still in the growing phases of that, and hopefully tools like Perception are of course helping big time with being able to curate some of this overflow of news and information. And Fernando, so you've had a different path to starting Perception. You've self-funded, you're bootstrapping the company, you haven't taken outside investment and diluted yourself. This isn't the typical route. So would love it if you can explain, your decision process there and, you know, maybe some words of advice that you may have.
Yeah. I mean, I just have always been entrepreneurial. I used to like resell basketball cards when I was like 8 years old. I like repackaged them and just set up a shop in front of the local supermarket and I was just slanging basketball cards. And then I, you know, when I was older, I started my career just like with my own record label. And I always been very self-sufficient, very independent. I lived alone since I was 17 years old. So I think just the entrepreneurial speaks to me a lot. And I just like to be able to move freely and quickly. And, you know, the more people that you put into a system, the more complex it gets. And it gets like, the complexity gets added by the individual. Like it's, you add, you know, one co-founder and you're two people, complexity is up for 400x. You add a third, complexity is up 17x. It's just insane how difficult it is to navigate humans, the more complex the system gets. And I think right now with like AI tools being so incredibly advanced, there's just a lot that you can do by yourself. Not to say that it's not, you know, it's not difficult and it's lonely at times. You do want to have a human sounding board. You can't just like, no matter how much you tell, you know, the AI, like, be critical of what I'm about to ask you, please. And then, you know, you're always going to have like this like sycophantic element in terms of like AI just telling you, you're absolutely right. So just go ahead and do that, right? But I think the power is in extreme curation and discipline. in terms of like what you build, and you should take as much calls with companies, even though they're not really a prospect. You should just like try to reach out to people and just hear them out and see what they're trying to do and try to build around that. For Perception specifically, I started it because I was scratching my own itch at Blockstream as the VP of marketing communications. I didn't have the right tools to really have a read of like, hey, what is Blockstream's like share of voice? And where are the opportunities that we can take just from a narrative standpoint? I just had to do all that manually. So I scratched my own itch and I created a newsletter based on some of the foundings that I found, because I thought that was a very interesting, you know, a lot of interesting data came back. And I'm very autodidactic. So I think like writing stuff is a great way for you to learn about any topic. So I took the data and I created a newsletter just to distill the thoughts and like really learn what I was gathering. And then as that newsletter grew and people started asking me like, hey, are you releasing this data? Are you making this data available? I was like, I don't know. Do you want it? It's like, yeah, I want it. Okay, how do you want it? Yeah, an API will be cool. Okay, how much are you willing to pay for an API that gives you this? Now, okay, I'm willing to pay this. So I'm like, okay. That was like a inspirational moment. And then I emailed people like Nick Carter, Lynn Alden, out of the blue. They didn't know me from Jack. And I was like, hey, I have this idea. And I had created a survey, 4 or 5 questions. It takes you literally 5 minutes. If you want to like help me out, all I'm asking is just click on the buttons, answer some of the questions. And, you know, those questions were filled of like, you know, if you had this, would that help you with this? And how much would you pay to get this out of the way? How much time do you spend every day, every week on this specific thing? And as I just cold emailed people, not only did I get answers to my questions to get some initial validation of like what could potentially be built, but I also made connections. Like these people, some of them I talk today and I can just hit them up on a DM, because that whole experience of like asking them for a survey and getting on a call with them, like, hey, we like each other. We're like, hey, I think you're cool. So it became like it's a networking thing as well. So a mix of all of that, plus people actually telling me like, I'm willing to pay if you release this. That was kind of like enough. And I immediately understood that this has the potential to become profitable very quickly if I price it right and if I find the right businesses. And I was profitable after 2.5 months, 3 months, which is insane. I had enough like confidence from the feedback to leave Blockstream. But then after two, 3 months, I was already profitable. I was lucky enough to be like, when I left Blockstream, I created this like press release. Hey, I'm leaving Blockstream. And then I'm like, okay, let me send this to people. And like Bitcoin Magazine made an article, like, and then I went on Peter McCormack. And then on the day the episode went out, I did my own announcement. Hey, I'm leaving Blockstream. And a lot of people gave me a lot of, you know, kudos and feedback on that. So that helped me get a lot of people interested. I got some DMs from that and became profitable pretty quickly. And then, you know, as I understood that after the first 3 months after leaving Blockstream, I was like, okay, if I am trying to get a co-founder or a partner or somebody to like split the profits now, then the profit margins will go insane. How can I leverage AI to kind of like do a lot of these things from technical to strategy to like everything? And I kind of like taught myself in the process of that. I taught myself like how to create an agentic workflow, how to like, what are the differences between different models and different API companies. So, you know, it's all a learning curve. And I think if I had to have a committee to discuss all of these things, instead of just like jumping in and just like exploring and discovering and learning and failing constantly, I think I would be not as good as where I'm at right now. Maybe it would take me like longer to get there. So like that's kind of like why I love the bootstrap mode and, you know, the full freedom to just like learn and fail and execute without any bias, you know? And then the funding is okay, if you want to build like real infrastructure, I understand why people want to go and fund this, you know, fund a company. But I think if you provide a service, it's like B2B, very niche, It's like niche enough so that the big companies doesn't kill you, but it's not small enough so that you can actually build a profitable business and have like a really good life. Then I think that's the sweet spot that you need to look for when building a business right now, because if you want to compete with the VCs in terms of like creating proper infrastructure, yeah, that's a whole nother ball game. And at this point in my life, I want to just enjoy it, you know?
You know, I mean, it really, when you think about the point in time in which you elected to leave Blockstream and start building this, August of 2025 to today, I mean, I've just noticed the evolution of AI in the first half of 2026. It's, I mean, it's phenomenal. You probably picked exactly the right time to be a company builder that's also using AI tools for your growth and expansion. But as you, I mean, you, as somebody who's really worked with it as it's evolved in this rapid pace, how do you think about the future, and how do you think about going forward with using AI tools and adding different, I don't know, different other services to what you have now? I mean, what do you as a founder think about as you're kind of an AI centric company builder?
I think you got to be nimble enough to make a lot of hard pivots on the fly, In August 2025, I was convinced I was going to build a platform. By January, I was like, I'm going to be an MCP company. And so I could have had like, oh, the sunk cost of like, fuck, man, I spent hours building this platform and just so many hours building. I can't let it go. And I was like, no, I need to let it go. Well, not let it go. I mean, the platform is still available and there's still, 20% of my users still go to the platform. But the platform has become like a place for you to log in and get a screen, like a snapshot of the market. And then that's it. The actual tooling and the plumbing and the stuff that people build on, that's on the MCP. And that's way more impactful. So the platform became like a afterthought of like, hey, on top of the MCP, you get a platform where you can just log in and get the latest. But that's like that alone is not the business. But I thought that was the business 7 months ago. So in this fast-paced environment where there's a lot of development happening and that changes the way companies build and do their business, you got to watch that and be like, hey, companies are downsizing 40%, 30%. They're hopping on the AI train. Okay, then that means that they are in this transitional period where they're trying to figure out what exact internal workflows and tools is for their exact need. And you got to be the one that's like, hey, let me help you out with that, with this data for your marketing department. You got to be like very specific, very niche, and just offer them a service that is flexible enough to survive, you know, and that data is that thing. Platforms, tools is really not, you know, because ultimately every company that feels more confident about AI in the future are just going to build their own tools. So you can't provide a tool, especially unless that tool is like something insane that, you know, either protects a lot of capital or does a lot of very sophisticated things that could make you a lot of money. But if it's just like, I don't know, very mundane things that are like important on a day-to-day that people can build themselves, you're going to be out of business in less than 12 months. So try to build the tooling, try to build the infrastructure that plugs into that new reality. And I think that is what perception's competitive moat in a nutshell, which I stumbled upon. Honestly, that was not what I was out to do when I left Blockstream. I did not think, I'm going to create an MCP that is kick-ass, that's going to revolutionize how people build their internal tools. No way in hell I was thinking that. But my users told me that this is what they need, and I learned from them. And I think that's the thing that you have to have that mentally. You got to be nimble enough and not be afraid to pivot on your darlings, you know, no matter how much time you spent on them, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it absolutely does. I mean, take the step, stay nimble and profitable, probably not bad, simple rules to go by. Really appreciate all of the, you know, backstory and advice there, Fernando. It's great to hear from someone who's discovered where the real value for their product is early on. So, you know, congrats for everything you're building at Perception, and you know, 7 months in, you're already hitting some important milestones. So that's amazing to see. And anyone who's maybe interested, Fernando, in trying out Perception, where do you want to point people if they are interested in this intelligence platform?
You can just Google, you know, Perception MCP. You'll find the website, perception.to. It's a free forever plan that gives you 5 requests a day that you can just start right now. You don't even need to do anything crazy. Just this is one line command in your terminal, and then you're good to go. But if you want to check out like the entire suite, if you want to check out the platform, you want to do some automations, you want to set up some signals and the whole thing, then there's a free 14-day trial that you can sign up for, and it gives you higher MCP usage as well during those 14 days. So you can, if you really want to put some agents in, put into work and see what Perception can really do in terms of like your research, your content, or your just, you know, your communications output. I think you get a very generous MCP and API limits for those 14 days to really see how transformative Perception can be inside your workflow. So give it a go there, perception.to.
You talked early on in the interview about how we as Bitcoiners often don't do a good job of communicating the value or the narrative. What advice would you give for somebody who's looking to, you know, share what we believe is, you know, a more important, more equitable, more, you know, fair and reasonable democratized financial system with everybody. What advice would you give for somebody that's looking to share the Bitcoin story?
Be like, focus on empathy. Think about the person that you're talking to, and see if there's a Bitcoin angle. It's not, there might be, you know, you'll see a situation where there might not be a Bitcoin angle for that specific person. And that's okay. We don't need to orange pill the entire world within our lifetime. We need to find the people that really need Bitcoin for whatever reason. And we got to like, listen to them. We got to hear them tell you the reason. It's not your reason. It's their reason that will convince them about Bitcoin. And I think now and in the future, it's going to be way more intense in terms of how individuals are just consuming content. So you got to be like very specific about like, hey, what do you listen to? Like, do you like Joe Rogan, or do you have some other like thought leader that you listen to? Try to understand that content consumption of that individual to understand what that individual believes in, and then find a way to Trojan horse Bitcoin if there's a fit. And I know that's a super challenging thing to do, but honestly, you're just going to end up like a lot of Bitcoiners I've seen on X, just like hitting the heads against the wall and just like rage quitting, orange pilling as a whole, because they've been so frustrated with the process. But now more than ever, just ask questions and listen. And then you should, if you know about Bitcoin well enough, based on the answers that you hear, you should be able to find the Bitcoin angle, because Bitcoin is good for so many different things. If you're a leftist, if you're a right winger, I mean, Bitcoin still makes sense. So you got to just find those angles and communicate better.
Can you point people to where they can follow you? Any conferences you're speaking at coming up, or what's a good takeaway? And we can add those to the show notes, Fernando.
I find my shit post on X, on based layer. That's my handle. I don't do that many conferences. I like to travel a lot, but I always travel to places where there's no conferences. So you won't find me on a conference, this year, I think, but, based layer, and just Google my name and you'll find all the handles and stuff if you want to, you know, be exposed to my shit posts.
Well, great, Fernando. I mean, we appreciate the time. It's very, you know, it's very interesting to see firsthand what you're building. I know when we connected, I was surprised with everything that you had already accomplished in at the time, 6 months, I suppose, now 7. So, you know, wishing well for the next few months. I'm sure you'll have a lot more ahead for the company, and we'll be sure to check back in at some point in the not too distant future. But appreciate the time. Thanks for coming on to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on, guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Build with Bitcoin. If you found it of value, please take a second to like, subscribe, or share. This helps the visibility and reach of our podcast so that more people are aware of the innovation happening in and around Bitcoin. It truly means a lot. I'd also like to take this opportunity to invite you to join us at an event that Israel and I are hosting, Meet to Tech Talks 2026, taking place from October 25th to the 27th at the exclusive Punta Mita Resort in Mexico. This will be an intimate gathering of 125 invite-only participants exploring how the future of capital is being shaped by the intersection of Bitcoin, artificial intelligence, and energy. To request an invite or for more information, visit mitatechtalks.com. We hope you'll join us. And thanks again for being a part of the Build with Bitcoin community.